ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 2, Part 2.
I just want to clarify something just for people who might be listening back to the recordings in retrospect. We had a question, I won't say who asked it. Somebody was saying that the diagram descriptions did not match up with the questions in the exam. What actually happens is Cisco randomizes the questions in the exam, so they never get presented in the same order, and you need to use the strings of text out of the exam answer file to match it with the diagram descriptions. We don't give you the whole question because then people would be able to study for the test from the exam diagram descriptions and look the answers up in their notes. So you'll have to use Control F and put in a part of that phrase to find the one for the exam diagram descriptions, or read up and down through the file until you find the exam diagram description you want. But it does actually randomize the question order, and there's not much we can do about that. It's meant to stop people from cheating, because otherwise you'd be able to SMS your pal and go, what's the answer to question 7? And believe it or not, people do it. We have SMSs bouncing around the place, all over the place in university these days. It's disturbing.
Wow, that triggered my microphone. Bless you.
Grace, you mentioned last week about looking up computer cases. I have a question about something I found. That seemed to be common throughout a website. Then may I ask?
Go for it. Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, there seemed to be any number of different cases. I think it was Magic Micro or something was the website. But the almost every case had a link, and the letters Tango Mike Bravo TMB link. What does TMB stand for?
I have no idea what that's about. If you send me a link to the website, I'll look at it, but that's not a common thing. I have no clue. I don't think it has anything to do with the case, but if you send me a link to the website, I'll look at it, and I'll try and figure out what it is.
I know what it is.
Oh, what is it?
TMB stands for thumbnail, and if you actually click on the TMB link, it gives you a big picture of the case.
Oh, how about that?
Thank you, sir.
No problem.
Wow, good job.
I had no idea either, but I just worked it out.
I clicked on it, but I didn't pick up on that, and I obviously couldn't see what it was doing, so thanks.
No, it's fine.
A picture.
It's very important to have a picture of a case, because often you can't tell whether you like a case if you're sighted until you see the picture of it and see where all the drive bays and stuff are laid out. But if you were to have, say, you know, 200 or 300 K JPEGs for a picture of 20 cases, you'd have about 4 meg of pictures that would take a long time to come down. And as Ellis will tell you, probably on this lecture for free, but if working for a consultant for quite a bit of money, keeping the size of the pictures down on a website is important because it decreases load time. So if you want a big picture of something, you then click on the link and that pulls up the big picture, which is why you don't just copy the files directly from your digital camera up onto the website, because they're 3 to 5 meg a piece and nobody wants to download pictures that big. But that's not a topic for this lecture. It might be a topic for a Thursday chat or something in the future as to how to bring your pictures down to acceptable sizes. The same is also true for audio files, which I was just responding to one of our local comments who said that she doesn't really care about big pictures, which is fair enough, but downloading big audio files can be a bit of a problem, so, you know, MP3 is good. All right, it's all yours, Grace. You might as well.
All right. So any other general questions, or are we ready to begin? All right. I guess we're ready. All right. So we're going to start ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 2, Part 2. And I have one note before we start about the second lab, the Complete Computer Disassembly and Reassembly. And that is that if you do not have a computer to tear apart, there are demonstrations, and those demonstrations of how to do it are audio, and they will be up on the QCAT site in our audio folder at the end of this lecture or shortly thereafter. So you will be able to do that lab. You don't get out of it. You get to hear the nice, I think it's Carrie and Geraldine taking apart the computers, right?
Yeah, it is. Actually, I think they're actually in the audio folder already. They're in the root of the audio folder. You go to ITE1, and then they're in audio. I'm just going to double-check that, and I'll get... Yeah, and they're actually being put in there so that you can actually find them. Because there's two classes this year, we just separate out the audio into two different class folders so that you can download the lectures for this class or the class we ran beforehand. And I'd just like to point out very quickly that it's also, if you want more material to listen to, now I realise a lot of you probably don't, but some people actually do, do feel free to listen to the older lectures and stuff because you get different perspectives and different ideas on what actually was said in the older lectures. And for example, we have the ITE1 class that we ran early this year, the one that Grace was a student in before we instructorized her, along with Elise. And we also have the one from last year, and we also have the one from the year before. But, I mean, the one from last year and the one from this year are actually quite good reference material if you honestly want something else to listen to. So you don't have to, but it is an optional thing you can do.
So if anyone...
Okay, that's fine, Mark. We'll talk about that later.
Board?
Yeah, he's found a motherboard. What he thinks looks like a motherboard.
Oh, gotcha.
You actually have enough vision to use the virtual assemble your computer tool that's available on the ITE1 site, so maybe you want to look through that and download it and see if the board you found looks like the one on the screen in the virtual assemble your PC tool. Unfortunately, that is not accessible to vision-impaired people who have no sight at all. But yes, there is actually a virtual assemble and disassemble your computer tool that you use the mouse to do, and you can see what all the pictures look like. So there you go. That's how you can figure out whether it's a motherboard or not.
Okay, so if anyone has any questions about either of those labs, the either worksheet, now we'll go...
Yep, you're up.
Okay, so we are going to start... We may have gone over this, but I think if we have, we're going to go over it again because it is so important. We're going to start with personal reference tools. Now, can anybody tell me what a personal reference tool might be? What do you think that is?
I just want to make a point here. They're actually under a directory called Audio Lab Recordings in the ITE1 subfolder. That's where you can listen to the computers being disassembled. They're actually in their own folder. I apologize for that. Now back to your scheduled program.
No problems. Okay. A personal reference material, they are what you will use to solve problems. Things such as notes and online resources. And we'll go over them in more detail in just a minute. Be sure to make notes as you go through the investigation and repair process. You can have a journal. You can document your upgrades and repairs that you perform, including descriptions of the problem, possible solutions, and the steps taken to repair the problem. You keep a history of repairs, that, you know, it's the journal. Make a detailed list of problems and repairs, including the date, replacement parts, and customer information, if necessary. If it's just you, then you don't have to worry about your own information as a customer. Technicians can post their journals online. You can have your own personal blog that you can let other technicians or your friends see, and it'll be kept online for you. I use livejournal.com, but you can use Blogger or anything else that you'd like, or you can set up your own blogging type of thing, your own website, and keep it up there. But it's really helpful to keep notes of that. And if it's online, you just have a history and you just scroll through. You might even be able to search it and say, oh, I think I had this problem. Let me just put in this keyword. I know I wrote that. Oh, there it is. So that's a really great idea if you want to have it online.
Just a point that you probably don't want to put people's personal information on the online version, just the general problem descriptions and solutions, but you will keep customer information in your personal records. If you actually scroll through my blog, which I'm not allowed to hand out because some of it isn't work safe, you will actually find references to repairs and things that I have done. So if you were to Google up my blog and you were to find it, it's not difficult to do, you would find that sort of repair information, but I'm not actually going to point you at it directly.
We also have our internet reference tools, and we have lots of Thursday chats that I can point you to. We have a Google Thursday chat, we have a research a few Research Thursday chats, I believe. We also have a couple on study skills. So if you feel like you're not doing too well with the studying, you can go and listen to those as well. And the Thursday chats are a great online reference tool, and they'll teach you how to use the other great online reference tools. So we've got our internet search engines. What internet search engines do people like to use?
Anyone? Anybody use a search engine?
Google.
Yeah, that's one. Anybody use anything else other than Google? Google's pretty good. I like Google.
I love Google.
There's also Yahoo.
Yahoo and MSN, okay. Yep, there's also a new one called Bing that Microsoft released recently. Apparently it's not bad.
Has anyone played with that?
No.
I did Windows Update today on this machine, and it wanted me to install Bing, but I think I passed.
Oh, that's nasty.
No, Bing may have just been an add-in to your Internet Explorer 8. Remember, Internet Explorer 7 and 8 have a list of search engines that they can query if you type in a search term from the address bar. It may have just wanted to add Bing as an extra search engine to the list of search engines that you're going to use. Of course, it is up to you whether you add that in or not, but usually in the first run wizard of Internet Explorer 7 and 8, it asks you what your default search engine is and what search engines you'd like to add. So perhaps that was what happened.
Okay.
It probably does, but I'm not sure how accessible the AVG toolbar is with speech.
Not that accessible.
In fact, I would steer people away from AVG Internet Security, generally speaking, from an accessibility standpoint, because a whole stack of the dialogues are unreadable with JAWS. The antivirus package alone is okay, but the actual Internet Security is a bit difficult to navigate with screen readers.
Okay, we have news groups. Does anybody use the news groups?
Me. Has anybody ever heard of news groups, come to think of it? I'm really serious here, guys, because, I mean, not everybody's used Usenet News. Anybody used Usenet News?
I've never used it, but I've heard of it.
I used to use news groups, but I didn't have enough time to keep up with it.
Well, these days, you don't have to keep up with it. There's search engines like Deja News, which actually will search Usenet for various information. I think somebody once described Usenet as a huge herd of stampeding elements with a whole lot of noise and excrement, but with a couple of gems of wisdom. So you have a lot of people posting to Usenet, and some of it is absolutely excellent, and some of it perhaps isn't so excellent, but there is a wealth of information. In fact, one of the news groups, news.answers, has a monthly post of just about every frequently asked questions that comes up on Usenet news groups. Everything from Rec Arts Erotica to comp.computers, and it's certainly a resource that you should at least know exists, even though you may not refer to it. Also, because Usenet is historically difficult to access, a lot of the script kiddies and the regular internet people don't tend to frequent the news groups, so you tend to get, these days, quite a cream of technical elite, because if you've got enough knowledge to get onto the news groups, you've obviously done enough research to be fairly good at what you do, and you tend to actually get a higher quality of information on Usenet than you used to. So, yeah, interesting resource. Although, as I said, you can often get them in Google posts and things, and you can also get them through Deja News. And I think web-based reading is free, but if you actually want access to their NNTP servers, you've got to pay them. How can I put this? Less scrupulous people often obtain a lot of illegal material off Usenet, and I certainly wouldn't condone that sort of behaviour from any of our students, but a lot of people do get material off Usenet.
Just wanted to see if anyone else had anything to add on news groups. Okay, we've got manufacturer FAQs and online manuals. These are great. Most people now put their computer manuals online. So if you are good with PDF documents, you can download them. There are plenty of good PDF readers. Adobe will let you read accessible to format them for you. Also, you can do Jim El-Mazoui's PDF to TXT, or Kurzweil will even do them. And I believe that Nuance also has a PDF converter, but you have to pay some money for that. All right on.
I was just going to point out the Jamal El-Mazoui PDF to TXT now has an OCR engine built in as well, so it's certainly worth a look.
And I think that you can go and get that at empowermentzone.net.
.com.
.com.
TheEmpowermentZone.com.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, yes, Ed Sharp does do it as well, because he probably just reused the same code libraries that he snarfed and stuck into PDF to TXT. That's a pretty JAML thing to do. But yeah, it's worth knowing about. Ed Sharp is pretty cool. And so is that other editor, TextPal, although Ed Sharp is meant to replace TextPal. If you don't know anything about these things, actually, I must say, and somebody correct me, because I have yet to find a good site that actually summarises all of the stuff that you can actually download from Jamal Mizrui. Usually he just hands out these direct links in emails to things that he's written. There's no central repository for all the stuff you can snarf off him.
Nope, there is not. The grab bag site that he directs you to is about the best one, but it's a little bit hard to... find stuff on there, and maybe an email or two would go a long way to fixing that. But it's all really good stuff, and he does do some great PDF to TXT stuff. I really, really like it. Yep, I'm seeing that. Okay. We also have online forums and chat. Now, it's very difficult to go through a forum sometimes as a blind person, because it's just a huge website of all of this stuff and extraneous messages. The best way I find to go through forums is to Google a question, and you'll see forums, and then you just click on the page and look through the relevant thread. That's my favorite way to go through that. Online chats, some of them are accessible, some of them are not. There are some really good ones, there are some terrible ones. So use that... insert escape with JAWS to refresh the screen as often as you can, and you might get somewhere.
There are also programs that have IRC channels, Internet Relay Chat. That's another good reference, especially for Linux problems and questions and stuff. There are lots of Linux IRC servers that you can use.
There are technical websites. If you Google a question, you might get to a technical blog or website where you can find out the answers to your questions. There are a lot of techies that like to blog. Even some of the online journals and blogs are Googleable, so you might find a website of somebody who has solved the problem already. And if it won't hurt your computer, you can give it a try. If not, you need to think about how valuable whatever it is that you might accidentally destroy is to you, and decide whether you want to try the solution or not. But it's always up to you, and it's always at your own risk. You can't really come back on these people and be like, this didn't work, you know, and it's all on you, and you get to decide what you want to do.
Just a warning, expertsexchange.com will show you all sorts of really handy-dandy information except for the answers to any of the questions it's got, and you have to actually pay them money to see the answers. So just be warned about that.
Oh, that's great.
But if you want another good free resource for answering questions that we came across recently is a thing called Aardvark. www.vark.com, and you can sign up and say what sort of things you'd like to answer questions on, and it can send you on things on information, information on things, and then you can actually answer other people's questions, and it can be a bit annoying, but you can actually set it up to be quite useful.
You can also use that. It's an MSN. You just type your question to MSN, and hopefully someone will write back with you in an answer in, 3 to 5 minutes or so is what I've found.
Her username should be Jenny Dean, the password should be Dawson.
Okay. We are going to... does anyone have any questions on the personal reference tools? There are a lot more things that you can find. Just explore the web, use your search engines, and have fun. And remember, if it doesn't sound like something you want to try, don't. But you're welcome to try anything you'd like.
Just as another point, also be aware that the JAWS training material, if you have a copy of JAWS, contains extensive information on how to use your internet browser. I'm going to say it once, I'm going to say it 1,000 times this semester, getting to know your Internet Explorer quick keys is going to save you so much time that it really is worth doing. Insert F1 twice quickly in Internet Explorer, nobody ever presses it, and it will tell you how to use those quick keys. Things like N to jump to the next non-different element, M to jump to the next frame, E for the next edit field, all those sorts of things. You'd be surprised how much quickly you can get around pages. Also, I'd strongly suggest that you use the arrow keys to read your pages, not tab. Because
you miss all the text if you do the tab.
That's right.
Yep, and we have had some students that have honestly said, I tabbed all around and I didn't find it. I said, did you read the instructions above the link? No.
What instructions?
Mm-hmm.
They would have missed them.
They would have.
I jumped straight over the top of them.
Yep. Make sure to explore. Okay, we're going to go quickly, unless anyone else has something to add for proper tool use. We're going to go very quickly over the proper tool use stuff. Okay, I guess we're good, and we're going to go on to proper tool use just very quickly. Oh, there we go. You got it set up. Now, we're just going to quickly go over how to use an anti-static wrist strap to prevent ESD. What we do is we wrap the strap around our wrists and secure it using the snap or the Velcro. Then you take the metal on the back of the wrist strap and make sure it remains in contact with the skin at all times. You snap the connector on the end of the wire to the wrist strap, and then you connect the other end either to the equipment or to the same grounding point on the anti-static mat that you're going to use. Any questions on the wrist strap? Okay, we're going to go to the anti-static mat. This draws static electricity away from a component and transfers it safely from equipment to a grounding point. So, you lay an anti-static mat on the workplace next to or under the computer case, usually under it. Clip the mat to the case to provide a grounding surface on which you can place parts or your computer. Ground the workbench and the anti-static floor mat, of course. By standing on the mat and wearing the wrist strap, your body has the same charge as the equipment and you have much less chance of ESD. Okay, we're going to just talk about do's and don'ts with the screwdrivers, and we're going to do a little more describing of the tools. We've got the flathead screwdriver, and we use the flathead screwdriver for slotted screws. The screw with that little line about as big as your fingernail down the middle of the screw. Don't use them to take apart Phillips. No, you only need one. They're big enough to put a few parts on, usually, as well as your computer case.
You only need to put the parts you're working on. Oops, you only need to put the parts you're working on the anti-static mat.
All right. We use... putting the parts on it. I'm sorry. You put... or the case. The case stands on the mat. You can put your parts on the mat. It just all depends on what you're doing. If you're taking parts out, we're going to put the parts on the mat. If we're working inside the case or cleaning it or just making sure a part is seated into the case, we're going to stand the case on the anti-static mat.
You don't have to stand the case on the anti-static mat. You can actually stand the case on the bench as long as it's wired to the anti-static mat. That's why you've got the wire that runs from the case to the anti-static mat, so that you're equalizing the charge between the anti-static mat and the case. So it means you've got the case sitting on the bench wired to the anti-static mat. And then you can put all of your parts that you're working on, such as the system boards and the RAM and the hard drives and stuff, on the anti-static mat. There are actually anti-static floor mats that are big enough for you to stand on, but I don't think that you would generally be working on those unless you're working in a specialized workshop. Nobody can usually afford those if they're a home user, unless they're particularly affluent.
Right. They always had us... they had us actually put our cases on an anti-static mat in the lab that I worked in. I don't know why, but that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to talk about a Phillips head screwdriver. This has the crosshead, and it has it's not the slotted, it's the normal kind of screw that is in most things. Don't use it to puncture anything. And don't use screwdrivers as crowbars, because you could break them. Yeah. honestly, guys. And don't use them. I don't know how you could use them to get a slotted screw out.
Well, basically what you do is you jam the little edge in and then you jam down on with all your force. Then you reef it anti-clockwise and then you get the hammer out and you belt it. And then when you actually tune up the whole head of the screw, you pull out the electric drill and you drill through the screw
drill it
and
out.
Belt it out with a hammer. Okay, now you get the idea. You shouldn't
don't,
do any
don't
of this.
Don't do that, you guys. In fact, only use tools for their intended uses. Don't use one screwdriver to take out another screwdriver. Try to make sure the screwdriver is the same size as the screws you're trying to take out. This is a very good idea. It goes a lot easier for you.
I'd just like to add a point that if you don't have the right screwdrivers, save up your money and go down to an electronics shop and invest in a small technician's kit that has number one, number two Phillips, number zero Phillips, number one, number zero flathead, a hex driver, and a few other tools. You will find that it will serve you well in your computer repair. Do not try and improvise by using a screwdriver from the dollar shop, because the steel in the tips of them is not going to be strong enough and you're just going to burr out the screws. Put good money into your tools and they will serve you for a long time.
So having fun over there today, aren't they?
All right, we're gonna go on to the hex driver. Speaking of tools,
I shan't mention what the Australians call an American screwdriver.
What are they?
You'll have to tell me that later.
A hammer.
Oh, a hammer, okay.
We call them the American screwdriver.
Hammers come in different sizes, you know.
I think all tools come in different sizes, but seriously, invest money in your tools and they will serve you well for years to come.
Okay, we're going to go on to hex drivers now. Use a hex driver to loosen and tighten bolts that have a hexagonal head. Do not over-tighten hex bolts because the threads of the bolts can be stripped. That goes with any screw. Don't over-tighten them. Because, you know what, you'll also never get them off.
Don't do what the tradesmen do here, and that's two turns past stripping and back a turn.
Yeah, that's disturbing. And one of the other things I'd like to warn people against, electric screwdrivers are very nice if you have used a cordless screwdriver. But when you're using the cordless screwdriver, make sure that you release the trigger very quickly. If you've done a screw-up with an electric screwdriver and it's gone... you've tightened it too far. So you must let go of the trigger when you hear the pitch of the screwdriver change, or you will have over-tightened the screws with them, because they do have the power to tighten up screws exceedingly well, but it will end up stripping this thread and stuff. And in fact, I would caution, until you are actually good at using manual screwdrivers, that you avoid cordless hand-driven power tools until you actually know what you're doing, because it is possible to drill holes in the bottoms of system boards and stuff with cordless screwdrivers if you don't know what you're doing.
Do not use a hex driver that is too long for the bolts that you're using. Use a part retriever, not a needle nose pliers, to retrieve your parts such as screws. Do not scratch or hit any components when using this tool. Then the components will not work anymore. They have very tiny little delicate microchips, and if you are rough on them at all, they can very easily break. All right, any questions on proper tool use?
What is a parts removal tool?
They're these little metal...
three-pronged little... Have you ever seen a sugar cube retriever? Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. You press on the end, push in with your thumb, and long spread.
Yep, that's what it is. And you just pick up your little part, Usually, hopefully you have small fingers as a blind person, because I can never get those to work quite right.
Oh, Elise, are we keeping you up? Was that you yawning, or was that somebody else yawning?
No, it was me, sorry.
That's all right.
The Autovox is on, and of course the cat's walking past here, and interesting things are happening here in the office, but keep going, don't let me
stop. You might actually want to turn your Autovox off while you're not lecturing.
I think this tape is going to take a lot of editing.
Oh, we're not editing it. No, I'm not editing it.
Okay, so does anyone know why we would clean a computer? Yes.
Because it gets dirty and it gets rubbish in it and all that sort of stuff. Dust?
Absolutely. So it lasts longer. Yes, it does get dirt and stuff into it. But dirt can slow down the components and coat the components and coat your fans, and that really makes your computer's performance go down. And if you completely block the fans, then you overheat and you're done.
Now, I'm not going to have to make my stupid noise because this is a new IT1 class and I haven't heard it. Has anybody ever had a fan that go when you press the power button that goes and then about 5 minutes later it stops? Has anybody ever had that happen?
Yep.
Yes. Particularly when they're cold sometimes.
Yes, well, usually that's because you've got dust on the sleeve bearings, and if you actually clean up the bearings and put sewing machine oil in them and stuff, which we don't cover in this course, you can actually stop them from doing that, and they'll last another year or two. If you don't do that, eventually they will seize up solid, and they won't spin anymore, and then you'll have to replace the whole fan, which is probably easier from a technician's perspective, but if you're on a budget, sometimes you can actually repair the fans you have and save yourself a few dollars, and that's important for some people.
Yes, we have a guy here in Melbourne who's very particularly good at doing that, and he likes to tell us so.
No, and there's a reason why. WD-40, a lot of them are sealed by a rubber plug, and WD-40 attacks rubber. I'd really suggest you use sewing machine oil, not WD-40, and I'd also suggest you don't get the can of WD-40 and go until your computer is a greasy mess, because you will get a whole lot of residue all over everything, and it is pretty feral. So unless you're going to use top quality WD-40, and you really shouldn't, I'd be using one of the silicon-based cleaners and stuff for that sort of thing, not WD-40. It's generally used for water repelling, and it's used on metal parts and actually stripping back rust. If you've got rust inside your computer, you've probably got bigger problems than WD-40 will solve for you.
Probably. Okay, does anyone have any ideas of what you might clean your computers with? And please say the part that you'd clean with the particular thing that you would be cleaning it with.
Soft brush for keyboards and, I don't know, maybe fans.
The keyboards, yeah, that's right.
Soft cloth for your display.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else got any ideas what you'd clean bits of computers with?
Compressed air in a can.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm just going to go over quickly what you use to clean which parts of the computer. We've got the computer case and monitors. Use a mild cleaning solution on a damp, lint-free cloth. LCD screens, use a cleaner that is specifically designed for the LCD screens. CRT screens, use distilled water on a dampened, soft cloth. Component contacts, such as your CPU base, or your RAM contacts, or your card contacts, you can use isopropyl alcohol.
Without liniment. Just making that very clear. If you go to the chemist and buy isocol, rubbing alcohol, and it actually has the liniment in it, do not use it on computer components. You just want the isopropyl alcohol, not the one that contains liniment. Very important.
And don't use regular rubbing alcohol.
Oh, I do that all the time. Just to make sure it doesn't have the liniment in it. But the actual technician-grade stuff is really expensive. But you can actually get the cheaper stuff from the chemist. So if they ask you in the test, don't do it. But the actual cheaper stuff without the liniment tends to be okay.
Now, for the LCD screen, at your own risk, Windex.
Pretty much. But don't use very much Windex. Do you use the Proma cleaner on any of your LCDs, Elise, or do you get the special LCD stuff?
I just use the damp, just the dry cloths that come with various LCD screens which I've bought. The best one being the one that I've got for my big TV in the lounge room.
You probably don't need to use need a cleaner unless you're really going to get gunk on them. I mean, a lot of the stuff should just be dust that's attracted and should just brush straight off.
In Denver, in the desert, you really had to use something with some liquid on it because the dust would just stick and it was really, really bad because it was so dry.
My uncle in the territory asked me how to clean the one I got for Yvonne last year because of the same problem, dust, dryness. So
it just clogged on there. You couldn't get it off easily with a dry cloth.
Yeah. Not sure what he's doing, though.
Seriously, a little bit of Windex goes a long way for that. Just a little bit, and you can get all that off and it'll be good as new. Go ahead.
I think someone just nudged their microphone.
Okay. Keyboards, you can use that soft brush and the compressed air. They say use a small handheld vacuum cleaner with a brush attachment. that should be okay on the keyboards, actually. For a mouse, use glass cleaner on a soft cloth. If you've got a mouse with the actual ball in it, you can take them apart. But good luck getting them back together. Do not spray glass cleaner directly on the components. Don't spray anything directly on the components. Always use a cloth, and you'll do much better. And that is the end of Module 2. Does anyone have any questions?
Okay, just about to hit stop and restart to start the next
recording. We're going
to do a quiz. Okay, let's put the quiz on the end then. Everyone in the chat window.
We're going to go A, B, C, or D. If there are multiple answers, we are going to do yeses and nos after each question, and I will let you know what the format of the question is before we get to the answers. It's Trevor.
You keep closing it.
No.
Okay, we are going to start now. Is everybody in their chat windows?
Jenny is Trevor, just so that you know, and Trevor is Jenny, which is interesting. They've just signed on each other's ventriloquist.
Oh, that's quite interesting. All right, everybody, here we go. Let me just get into my chat window here. There we go. Okay. What is the minimum level of electrostatic discharge that a person can normally feel? Is it A, 5 volts, B, 1,000 volts, C, 30,000 volts, or D, 10,000 volts.
Are you sure C wasn't 3,000?
It is 3,000 volts. It is 3,000 volts. No. You are right. And for those who said C because I can't read, that is correct. Whoops. My bad. Which recommendation should be followed first when a fire in the workplace is out of control? Is it A, try to use elevators to get to the lowest floor faster? B, contact emergency services for help? C, use a company water system to stop the fire from extending to other areas? Or D, try to control the fire with proper extinguishers? And absolutely. The fire is out of control. Get out of there and get a hold of emergency services for help. Okay, which two tools are recommended for cleaning a PC? We're going to choose two, so it's going to be a yes or no. Antibacterial spray.
Anyway. Yeah, that's good.
And that's correct? No. Compressed air? Absolutely. Mild abrasive detergent. Yeah, that's right. Nylon brush? On a cloth, no. Abrasive cleaner is not what you want to use, ever. Mild. The abrasive is the definite no on that one. And the nylon brush, no, that's a little bit too hard to use.
No, it's not actually for that reason. The reason you don't use a nylon brush is because nylon against other substances generates electrostatic discharge.
Oh, good point. Do we use rubbing alcohol? No, we do not. We want to use the isopropyl alcohol. Do we use a soft cloth? Yes, we do. Okay, and that is the end of that question. Good job, everybody. How does a technician discharge static buildup? Is it A, touching the painted part of the computer case? B, touching an unpainted part of the computer case? C, touching an anti-static wrist strap before touching any computer equipment? Or D, touching an anti-static mat before touching any computer equipment? No, someone got B, so that is correct. That is touching a non-painted part of the computer case. You do want to wear an anti-static wrist strap or an anti-static mat, but to ground yourself and to make yourself the same, this means the same voltage as the computer, you want to touch an unpainted part of the case. Which device is designed especially to protect computers and electrical devices from excess electrical voltage? Power strip, standby power supply, surge protector, uninterruptible power supply. And C is correct. Which three effects can be observed on computer components as a result of climate? We're going to choose three, so this is going to be yes or no answers, please. It will overheat if it is too hot. Moisture damages computer parts if it is too humid. Yep, both of those are correct. Computer components work too slowly if it is too cold. That's right. The risk of ESD increases if the humidity is too low. Absolutely. The risk of ESD increases if the temperature is too high. Nope. Components overheat if the humidity is too low. That is correct. All right. Which condition refers to a sudden and dramatic increase in voltage, which is usually caused by lightning? Brownout, sag, spike, or surge? Is right. It is a spike, a sudden dramatic burst in voltage that is usually caused by lightning. A surge is usually caused by fluctuations in the power grid.
The way I remember those, which is a bit silly, is imagine if somebody's sticking a spike into you, you'd go, ouch! Whereas if somebody sends a surge through you, you'd go, ah! Which is all a bit silly, but that's how I remember them.
That is the end of our quiz, and that is the end of Module 2. Does anyone have any questions before we go into Module 3?